Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, everyone. I'm Thinmoy Soundarajan, and this is our podcast, Cast United States with First Post. Today's episode is an exploration of caste and Christianity. Joining us is Dalit American Vani, who is a Dalit Christian feminist who grew up in Texas and now works across the U.S. on caste and gender issues. Welcome, Vani.
Thank you so much for having me, Thinmoy. It's good to be here.
Of course. So I'm really excited to talk to you as a Dalit Christian, because oftentimes South Asian Christians aren't a very well-known community, and let alone Dalit Christians. And so for folks who, you know, are getting to know how big a part of the diaspora the Dalit Christian community is, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about what it was like to grow up Dalit Christian and in Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the US, there are a lot of people that don't fully understand that Indian Christians or South Asian Christians in general exist. But even deeper than that, adding a caste analysis to it is one more layer to an already invisibilized population. But in Texas, because there's such a large South Asian population, there are many religions represented, many cultures and communities, but in specifically the Indian Christian sense, the people that have the power in those spaces are all Savarna people. And it's just an atmosphere of exclusion and an atmosphere where there are a lot of purity culture mentalities and a lot of ways in which religion is used to oppress people in general. And when we talk about Dalit Christians, even if people don't fully understand that there are certain practices at play, especially in the US, there's a lot of discrimination specifically towards Dalit Christians. We don't see Dalit Christians in a lot of power in a lot of general Christian spaces, general Christian South Asian spaces. So we are forced to have our own spaces a lot of times. And I think that's just the story of being Dalit in general, is creating your own space because you're not accepted in these other spaces. So in Texas, very, very similar to that. So we kind of move ourselves away from these larger spaces because we don't know what kind of discrimination we could face there, even though we're supposed to be accepted into a space that's our religion.
And I think this is really important for people that don't know a lot about the South Asian Christian tradition, is that you can basically both face like oppression from, you know, dominant caste networks that don't recognize religious minority faiths, you know, whether that's Christianity or Islam. But then once we're in those faiths as well, the way that Christianity is practiced differs from state to state within South Asia, but also the caste politics of each of those denominations. And I can imagine that in Texas, you would have a very strong Malayali Syrian Christian community, which is dominant caste, as well as these smaller pockets of Dalit Christian congregations that might be many different kinds of denominations, but who are living in fear of having their caste background found out. Can you share a little bit about that? Because I think that's really, for anyone that didn't grow up Christian, it all looks the same, because they're like, well, you guys are all Christians, right? Why aren't you guys getting along? And didn't people convert to Christianity to escape caste? So how is their caste in Christianity?
Right. And it should be that way. I think a lot of our ancestors converted to Christianity because they thought they can escape the caste system by joining another religion. And in a lot of ways, it has worked out. We had access to certain opportunities because we converted to Christianity. We had a lot more ways in which we could grow and take control of our lives because of the liberation orientation of Christianity in general. But I think at some point, a lot of Dalit Christians and Indian Christians in general come to the U.S. and join another fundamentalist kind of mentality. Because I think we're taught a lot that Christianity includes being pro-life and all of those types of policies and mentalities that are very conservative. And we forget about the liberation aspect of it. So in Texas, which is already a very red state, it's very easy to fall into these kinds of patterns. And I think in Malayali spaces specifically, which are these large Christian culture spaces that are very casteist and are also very exclusionary too, there is an invisible problem of caste there. I don't think a lot of second generation or first generation people fully understand how their practices are casteist and how their practices are exclusionary, but they still practice those things, right? They're still very much like, we are this sect of religion. We can only marry within this sect. We can only, if you're a brethren or something, you can only marry a brethren person. And I think a lot of that, again, has to do with if you're a certain denomination, then the hope is that there are everybody else in that denomination is also your same caste. But I don't know if there's that deep understanding there, because I don't think anybody looked at me or looked at other Dalit Christians that were not from Kerala and saw potential for anything other than just friendship, because they knew that their families would reject us. And it would be on the basis of, they're not from our community, but you know what that translates into. Right.
And I guess that's why I want to get really specific, because when we're talking about saying that we're seeing casteism from dominant caste Christians, it sounds like from what you're sharing that it looks like endogamy, where people are talking about marrying only within other Syrian Christian families. There's also a discussion of who is from a good family and who is from a bad family. But are there other ways that you see that casteism, and particularly if you have like experiences or memories that you have from growing up in that kind of mixing pot?
I think a lot of Dalit people that I've talked to in general in these spaces have never been able to put their finger on exactly what it is that made them feel excluded. But it's a general sense of we are superior and we know better and you are not fully included. And there are different standards that they have for themselves and different standards that they have for Dalit people. I think I remember one time I was having this conversation with a woman, and we were talking about this one woman that was a part of their community, and she was dating somebody that was not from their community. And the conversation was, yeah, she's rejected. You know, nobody would really want to talk to her. Her parents are ashamed of her, that entire conversation. And I remember saying, well, if I were to do that and came to this community, what would happen? And they essentially said, well, nobody would care because you're not one of us and you can do whatever you want because you are not representative of us in our community, right? So that was one small example. And I think there is just a lot of shaming when it comes to how you want to express yourself in general in these spaces. If I wore shorts, something that simple, there would just be a lot of shaming that would happen, because I think women in general are supposed to uphold whatever purity and dignity of their caste. So it would be like these very weird standards and expectations that would be put on us. And at the same time, it would be like, oh, but you're not one of us. Does that make sense? It was like a both and also not.
It sounds like there is like a reinforcement of Brahminical patriarchal norms in terms Absolutely. Of the control of women's bodies and the shame, really, like if you break out of those purity norms, and also endogamy, which is always like a clear sign of like caste practice when people are talking about who is good to be married, who is one of us, who isn't, you know, one of us, you know. And I guess that's what I'm curious about, because like a lot of people, you know, don't often hear second generation people talking about caste practices. And, you know, outside of these circles of faith, like, did you see this like operating in terms of your other networks, in terms of other South Asian friends or in college? Because I think that, you know, second generation people, particularly those that are born in the United States, the language of caste may or may not have been conveyed to us by our parents, because our parents often think like, if we don't talk about it, maybe they can escape it. But that often leaves us without the tools to understand what's happening when people are throwing caste bigotry at us. And I'm just curious, like, what your perspective was and if you experienced that.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people that I grew up with that were Dalit and Christian, we grew up without really understanding our Dalit identity. We grew up understanding that we are Christian, we converted, and this is what it looks like to be Christian, and this is what it looks like to be Christian in Texas. So I think a lot of us struggle to understand why we did not feel like we fit in these spaces, and we're intentionally not fitting in these spaces because we weren't given the language or the knowledge to fully understand and unpack our identities. We were just told that we were Christian. And this is a very common story for a lot of Dalit Christian people. But what I found is people that were not Dalit knew much more about the caste system and where they were placed in it, because there was a sense of pride that was there. For us to be publicly associated with the Dalit identity was a source of shame and was a source of humiliation. So I think we tried to hide from that as much as possible. And our parents and our families wrongfully thought that once we left South Asia and came to the US, that all of this would disappear. So I've had conversations with my family where I've pointed out certain casteist things that have happened, that now I have the language to call casteist. And they're mainly shocked because they don't imagine that these practices are passed down from generation to generation. Even if it's not called casteism, it is that. So I think what I have realized is, yeah, there's just a lot more people that are not Dalit that understand these dynamics and understand their place and are able to use that and wield that for their own power while continuing to oppress us in a lot of ways.
Can you give me an example, Vani, of something that happened, like that can give an example of that for our audience?
Yeah, I think one example that I can think of is a lot of Savarna Christian women felt very comfortable emotionally dumping on a lot of Dalit women. And they wouldn't do this amongst themselves, but they would be comfortable doing that with a lot of Dalit women and treating Dalit women like they were disposable. I remember one time there was this one woman that would talk to me about her issues for 5 hours at a time, no matter how much I objected or no matter how much I was like, I need to go, because there's just this idea that Dalit women can handle a lot of pain and it is our place to do emotional labor for a lot of people. So that's one way in which it showed up. It's so hard to talk about sometimes because they're so subtle. There's so many ways in which you pick up on different energies and you pick up on different underlying things without fully being able to point and say, this is what that is. So there are a lot more of those things that happened, and a lot of smaller examples of people just being very excluding of all of us and us that were Dalit having these conversations like, hey, why do you think that they don't want to include us when they're planning these meetings? Or why do you think they don't want to include us in these Christian spaces when they are making decisions that have to do with our larger communities and things like that? So there was a lot of those questions, and we didn't fully understand why, but they, even if they didn't know it was casteism, they were being casteist. So it was just a lot of being on the outside and trying to figure out why we weren't being fully let in into these spaces because of our Dalit identities.
And it's so frustrating, I think, because, you know, this is a common repeated theme I hear amongst Christians a lot, is that for Dalit Christians, I think the hope to escape caste really came with conversion. And, you know, generations that come after the first generation of conversion struggle with still being put into a casteist box, because even though you change your faith, people still know your family's ancestral background. And that exclusion happens both in the institutions of worship, but also in these informal networks all across the South Asian immigrant diaspora. And that's really the challenge, right? Is that, you know, for many of our communities, when they first immigrate, their lifeline are their Desi immigrant networks. And so if those networks are super casteist, you feel cut off from your only lifeline with regards to white supremacy.
Exactly. I know that in my experience, we went to a South Asian church once every 2 weeks, but our main church was a white evangelical church. So we were dealing with white supremacy and not feeling included by the white folks in our church. And then also when we went into these South Asian spaces, it was the same situation. It felt like there was no way that we could fully be ourselves. And I think a lot of Dalit people just started expecting that we wouldn't fit in and that nobody would talk to us. I remember having a conversation with my dad, and he said, oh, I go to church, I sit, and then I come home. That's just what church is. And I asked him, there's no community, there's no, you know, nobody's like talking to you, and what are you getting from that? And in his mind, he said that it doesn't matter. Like, church is somewhere that you just go sit and you come back. Nobody's supposed to talk to you. Nobody is supposed to really care about you, which is the opposite, really, of what Christianity is. especially liberation theology and beloved community teaches you. So it's just shocking to me that we've become so used to people not wanting to talk to us and people that are not wanting to build and form community with us. And we just accept it as the norm, accept it as what it is and what it should be when we deserve so much better consistently.
And this is a really poignant piece I've seen. You know, this is also something that I saw in my own family where my mom, you know, she said, it doesn't matter the denomination. We just go to the church and then pray and then leave. In that regard, faith became a personal practice, not one where you built communion, because the experience of being ostracized was so defining in so many different contexts. And I guess that's where I feel like, you know, there is a journey that many Dalit Christians have to take to be able to find peace with the divine, but also find liberation on their own terms. And I'm wondering, what was that journey like for you? And how did you find your pathway to, you know, to a liberated theological space?
I think, so I grew up, again, in a very conservative space, because we were taught that that was Christianity. If you weren't conservative, then you weren't Christian. So grew up with a lot of purity culture leanings, a lot of homophobic beliefs, and a lot of beliefs that were taught to us by the church without any critical thinking. I think I always knew something was off and something was wrong. I grew up in a neighborhood that did not have a lot of white people. And I started making friends with people that were LGBTQ earlier on in my life. And I think I was exposed to a lot of different types of folks from a very young age, and going into church and saying that my friends would burn in hell or would that God did not love them was a very shocking thing for me, because in my mind, I thought if I love them as much as I do, and God is supposed to be all loving, then there's something that doesn't match up here. So I think it started from just me questioning a lot of things. And I was reprimanded often for questioning the way that I did. We were taught that we shouldn't question pastors, that we shouldn't question people in authority. And usually those people in authority were upper caste, right? So we were taught that if we question them, something bad is going to happen to us, upper caste or white, depending on where we were. So I think from a very young age, I was just very interested in questioning and figuring things out for myself. And I did not identify as Christian for a very long time in my journey, because it was terrifying to think about the Crusades and to think about how missionaries were harming a lot of people and were adding to colonialism and all of these things. So there was a long period of my life where I did not want to be called Christian. I was figuring out what faith and what connection to the divine looks like for me. Then I discovered liberation theology. I read a bit of James Cone, and I started doing a bit more research into what does this faith look like for people that have been deeply oppressed. And when I started reading more liberationist texts, it started becoming easier for me to understand that a lot of what I was taught when I was younger, all of these beliefs were very, very wrong. And that, you know, something simple as women can preach if they want to, femmes can preach if they want to. There's nothing wrong with being in the LGBTQ community. I just think that reading some of these books kind of opened up my eyes. And I was able to come to the understanding that there are so many supremacies that are tied with religion. For us, it was Brahmanism and white supremacy that was tied with religion. And all these supremacist beliefs were being taught to us as God's word, which was absolutely false. And a lot of it was slaveholder mentality. And a lot of it was mentality to keep us down and to not keep us rising. We were not taught about the radical ways in which Jesus was, you know, against the empire and was an abolitionist and all of these amazing things. All those things were left out for us because they wanted to keep us down for the most part. So having that understanding and also just being a very curious person and curious kid just led me to shed a lot of those beliefs. And it took a long time. There's a lot of shame and there's a lot of humiliation when you start doing things that, you know, you were taught were wrong for all of your life. So it was a lot of undoing and unlearning to come to a place where I understand that I am divine and that I am connected to the divine. And it doesn't have to look like me falling into a box of religion or a certain type of Christianity that we've been taught. But I remember there were just very, very painful times where I was convinced that I was going to hell because I wasn't believing in some of these things. And it was a lot of work and a lot of meeting other Dalit Christians that were liberationist and learning from them and learning from each other. It was community. It was my own people. It was Dalit people that saved me. And I think it has been really profound to watch all of that unlearning and undoing happen in me, and being very, very passionate about making sure this next generation coming up doesn't have to deal with some of those painful things that we were taught, because none of it is true. It's all indoctrination to to keep us controlled and not living free lives. Like, I value my freedom in such a profound way. And I know that God does too. But I don't know if Dalit Christians are taught that from a young age. I think we're taught that God wants to control. And it leads into how we think about intimate partnerships. It leads about how we think about friendships and work. If you're taught that an authority figure wants to control you, you move with that. And I don't think there's any freedom in that. So it's just my journey to freedom has just been a lot of unlearning.
I think that there is a real truth to what you're saying, because it feels like every Dalit goes through this crucible where they have to defend their own internal understanding of their dignity and their self-determination against the spiritual infrastructure that would deny that. And it's such a hard journey because it's a very lonely one when you first do it, because you're up against like very prohibitory scriptures or condemnations or these divides of purity and pollution. But at the end of it, all we're looking for is to be seekers who can find freedom. And I think that there is a truth that, you know, we save ourselves when we speak our truth to each other as Dalit liberationists, you know, whether we're Christian or Muslim or Hindu or atheist or Buddhist or, you know, Ravadasya, the purpose of the journey is to seek freedom. And I think that's what I find so profound in terms of looking at this angle from the realm of Dalit Christian feminism, because in many ways, you know, to be able to know yourself is the purpose of the existential journey of religion. And so, you know, I really hear you when you say these things, too, because I think it's an important thing for our audience to understand, is that no matter what faiths Dalits go to, they still find caste with other South Asians. So you still have to go through this jaunt to find yourself at the end of it, and to also redeem the spiritual practices that have become infested with caste, even the ones that were there to help us to escape.
Absolutely. And I think there's also a lot of us are taught that ancient Dalit spiritual practices are demonic. So my journey has also been trying to figure out what those practices are and reclaiming that for myself too, and not being afraid again that I'm going to hell because of a spiritual practice that is not Christian. And I think one thing that you said about being polluted, that really struck me, because Brahmanism teaches Dalit people that they're polluted. And in the US, it shows up in larger Christian circles where Brahmins are in power. And it also shows up in white Christian spaces too. There has been a lot of work that I've had to do to stop feeling inherently unclean. I think a lot of Dalit women and Dalit people struggle with feeling unclean in general and not being able to place, why do you feel this way? And it's a bit of, you know, a lot of generational trauma, and also the teachings of the church and the teachings of Brahmanism that were wielded against us and used in a way to keep us feeling polluted so we wouldn't rise up in our power and our freedom. And I think that's really important for folks to understand, especially when it comes to things like purity culture.
Well, and maybe we could talk a little bit more about, you know, that feeling of being unclean, because this is a theme I've heard with a lot of Dalit people behind closed doors, is that people are afraid to go to other people's houses, or sometimes they'll feel like they're washing their hands frequently because they feel dirty. And it's like a psychological trauma of being told that you're polluting. And I'm wondering, did you see that show up in your family or in yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of my family refuses to eat off of another person's plate, even if they're in the same family. They think it's just really disgusting. And I know that comes from like a casteist way of looking at things. I think for me, it showed up when I was in just society in general. I would just feel very unworthy of being there and very like just unclean. I would look around and it would feel like people were dressed better than me or people looked cleaner than me, when all of these things were false. Every single belief that I had was false, but it still showed up in my mind. And I had to deal with that and naming that and trying to understand, okay, why do you feel like everybody looks cleaner than you, looks better than you at a very just simple, superficial aesthetic level? And then why do you feel that you yourself are an unclean person? Like you can't do certain things because you're polluted. And asking those questions and understanding Dalit identity, that was the time when I fully started to explore, okay, what does this mean to be Dalit? Because I didn't know that I was Dalit as I was growing up. Like I said, a lot of Dalit Christian families keep that knowledge from you, but it doesn't really take away from the traumas, the inherited and the ones that are happening in real life. So I think my mom said something about, you know, we're untouchable. And that's when it hit me. And that's when I started doing more research and doing more internal work and reaching out to other people. And that's what really began my journey. And it all clicked. It all makes sense when I found out when I was a teenager. But I dealt with the unclean thoughts well into my 20s. It wasn't something that went away in a month or even a year. I think it takes a lot of shadow work and a lot of looking at these deep, uncomfortable truths that you were taught about yourself to be able to be free and to be able to be free from thinking that anything I do makes me unclean.
I think this is really a very poignant note to all of those Dalit American parents that are out there. You know, there is no rule book for how to raise a caste-oppressed child in the United States, let alone in India or any of our other South Asian homelands. But I think that, you know, for that first generation that gets education and is trying desperately to escape, for many people, and this was true also for my parents, they thought that they were protecting us by not discussing it. They thought that they could, you know, keep us away from caste if the word caste was not uttered. And, you know, the exact opposite was actually true, because all of the miasma and the prejudice and the bigotry and the exclusion is there, but you don't have the rhetorical and ideological understanding to explain why it's happening, which is kind of worse, because bad things are happening, but you can't say what it is. And so then you personalize it, which is, again, something I've heard from so many second generation Dalits, is that we thought it was just me. I was this way. But the door opening to understanding the identity and to understand the exclusion through the lens of caste opened up a whole other way to look at this through the structural lens, which is really what gives us the remedy to address it once and for all.
Absolutely. When we don't have the framework and the language, we end up being very lost. And like you said, we end up personalizing it. And when we're not able to voice exactly what it is, we can't build community. We can't talk about it with other people. So I think it's crucial that we talk about caste identity from a very young age. I'm very open with everyone about my caste identity, because one, there's no shame for me in it. And I think that's, again, a privileged place to be in. I know I'm in the US and there are less barriers now that I have than many other people that came before me. But I think it's crucial to talk about caste. I think it's crucial to make sure kids know about it so they don't struggle as much, because it's not fair for a lot of us.
And I think this is really important for people to understand, you know, the open bigotry that dominant caste children have been trained to, you know, exact upon their caste oppressed counterparts really can't be underestimated. And Vani, I'm wondering if you can share with me that example that your friend shared with you that happened at camp, when one of the dominant caste children was like trying to name the orders of who could eat first in the mess hall.
Yeah, I think one of my friends told me that they were trying to eat and one of the dominant caste people looked at the darker skinned Dalit people and said, slaves eat last. So it was a very shocking thing to hear, because again, we're in the situation where other people know who you are and you don't. That is a terrifying place to be in, and also not fully understanding that it wasn't just colorism that made people say that. There was something a little bit deeper going on than that. But I remember hearing it and being shocked, because who says that? Who says things like that to people?
I mean, dominant caste children that have been miseducated by their bigoted parents, that's who. And sadly, like, I wish I could say that was an isolated incident, but actually in our work in Equality Labs, we hear a lot of complaints of parents, you know, trying to comfort their children who are being bullied by dominant caste children. And, you know, that happened to me when I was growing up. And so I just think that it's a viciousness that we have to really kind of address. And it compounds the loneliness of our families, you know, which is why, you know, when you're thinking about a faith tradition, like, hopefully we would find some support there, but we don't find a lot as Dalit Christians. And so I'm really glad to hear your journey to finding and making your own community with other Dalit liberation theologists. And I'm just wondering, you know, for folks who are, you know, interested in learning more about Dalit liberation Christian traditions, you know, who are some people that people you would recommend people looking up, or books that you read so that people could learn more?
Absolutely. I think I learned a lot from Black leaders. So James Cone is definitely somebody that opened my eyes to liberationist thinking. And then more current folks are John Bhupalan and Roja Singh is another person, and Reverend Evangeline Rajkumar Anderson, a brilliant Christian Dalit feminist woman. Yeah, those are a few names that I think brought me to a lot of peace. And there are just a lot of really brilliant liberation theologians, but I think James Cone was the first one that started me on this journey.
So Vani, I know that, you know, one of the things that's also a really key part of your identity is being a femme and having a feminist politic. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you see caste and gender really operate in your world as a Dalit Christian? And what are the ways that you also kind of take on power as a Dalit feminist in response to that?
When it comes to the certain kind of Christianity that I was raised in, we were taught that women and femmes were not allowed to preach, were not allowed to have leadership, and were not really allowed to take up space for anything other than singing once in a while or whatever that might be. And I think that that kind of teaching makes you believe that you can't be the leaders that you want to be. So I think there was a lot of teaching that hindered a lot of women and femmes from being free. We were taught, you know, if we wore our hair a certain way, then we would be mistaken for prostitutes if we let our hair down. We were taught that if we wore anything revealing, that we were asking for it and God does not like that. We were tempting our brothers in Christ. We were taught that we have to wait for a husband to come and take care of us. We were taught a lot of sexist things growing up. And I think having that be taught to us by Brahmin people and also by white people is a lot to handle, because both cultures are telling you similar things. But in the South Asian culture, women are expected to uphold the purity of their caste. And I think a lot of our families thought by policing us that severely, that we would be upstanding, righteous, women of God type of person. But what that did was really take away from our ability to express ourselves, our ability to explore ourselves and our bodies, and our ability to really understand who we are as people. So I know for a lot of Dalit women, as we grow older and start coming back to ourselves, it's sometimes difficult to look at ourselves without the religion. We're taught that every single thing that we are is Christian, and you are nothing aside from that. Like, nothing else matters more than that. And when you are stuck in that kind of space, especially as a Dalit woman, you bloom a lot later and you find out all of these things that you like that you were taught were evil but are not. I know I did. I came into my power as I discovered hobbies, as I discovered people that I wanted to get to know, and as I discovered all these things that I liked that were apart from the Bible or apart from God. But I think there's such an obsession with that because, again, we're supposed to be these righteous, godly women and give every single part of ourselves up for that, but we really are just losing who we are. So understanding that my life has worth outside of any religion or a religious practice was the foundational building block into me discovering myself and discovering who I am. And I think as a Dalit feminist, it's been crucial for me to understand that those barriers exist. And my job is to break down those barriers so everybody can express who they are and be liberated from those shackles and those chains. And for me, the sin is putting all these restrictions on women. The sin is making us believe that we're helpless, that we are not leaders. The sin is making us feel like we have no worth if we don't have a husband. All of these things are sinful to me. And truth and God and love looks like being cut free from all of that and being able to fully express and know who we are and be the leaders that we are in any space that we go to without those barriers.
And I think it's very important to kind of look at these severe, you know, practices of policing of women and queer and femme bodies in all of these South Asian traditions as also a response to the severe trauma of caste-based sexual violence. Because, you know, beyond like the scriptural practice, my feeling, you know, and again, like I have Christians on both sides of my family, and it was only like two generations, you know, before that women in, you know, our family were allowed to wear a blouse. Before then, we had to be bare-chested or wear the sari without, you know, the thing because of the Brahminical patriarchal limitations of, you know, what we are allowed to wear. So I almost feel like sometimes, like in Dalit Christian spaces, people lean into the modesty, people lean into the policing of sexuality because there is no other form of control that they have when there's such widespread caste-based sexual violence. And of course, like as you said, like the approach here is not to limit, you know, women and queer and femme bodies, you know, right to dignity and autonomy and sexual exploration. But, you know, I think people use the tools that they had at the historical moment that they were at. But I think at this moment, particularly when we are at the cusp of so many liberatory possibilities through faith and through our movements, I think that we have to be able to approach another way. And it sounds like a lot of your Dalit Christian feminist practice has helped us do that.
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. It was a survival mechanism. And it was a lot of belief that if you looked a certain way, or you cover yourself up in a certain way, then maybe you wouldn't be as exposed to caste-based sexual violence. But we know that's not the truth. So I think you're right. We have to open up and have a much more radical imagination as to what liberation for Dalit femmes and Dalit Christian femmes looks like, because it's not working. And historically, it has not been working.
And it sounds like you and your Dalit feminist sisters are making a way by walking it, which is really powerful. So thank you for sharing that. And that I'm sure there's many people listening that can empathize with that journey. So thank you. Okay, wonderful. I really appreciate you joining us, Vani. And, you know, I wish you well in your journey as you continue to build Dalit feminist and Dalit Christian power. But, you know, want to also thank all of our audience listeners who joined us today. And if you want to learn more about CAST in the United States, please find us at equalitylabs.org. And also tune in for our next episode here at First Post. JBeam and Jay Savitri. Until next time, everybody.